Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And in this episode, I'm going to look at the concept of the Communist Party during the Stalinist era and the relationships, or just some of the relationships, that the party had with the wider population. During the Stalinist era, the vast majority of ordinary citizens come to see the state and the party that is inextricably intertwined with the workings of state machinery as a thing to be avoided, to be navigated around, to be negotiated with, and to some extent to be infiltrated. The state, this vast monolithic machine in the lives of ordinary Soviet citizens, is largely an obstacle, not a thing of any great affection. And this is because state power in the lives of Soviet citizens is arbitrary, and Soviet citizens would normally have encountered the state in the guise of corrupt or incompetent bureaucrats and officials, the little Stalins of Soviet life, the little Jobsworths, the clerks and the shop assistants and salesmen who were state employees, all of whom had little invested in any kind of public service and more invested in their own personal advancement through the systems and structures and hierarchies of Soviet life. By the time the Stalinist era begins in 1928, it was generally the rule of thumb where people see it beginning as it does rather emerge throughout the late 1920s, the Soviet regime has been around for 11 years, and during that time, a considerable portion of that time, has been fighting the civil war and other national conflicts, and of course fighting in places such as Poland. And so the generation of 1917 is still around. Obviously, by the time we get to 1936, 1937, that's going to be a different proposition altogether. But the party still viewed themselves as revolutionaries as opposed to anything else. And they were still engaged on a revolutionary mission of building socialism, which meant the rapid transformation of Russian society. This would not only mean an economic transformation of Russian society, but a social and cultural one as well, as the late 1920s and early 1930s see a cultural revolution happen in the Soviet Union, with old notions of pre-revolutionary Tsarist life being swept away, or to some extent they are anyway. And because of the historical worldview of the party, the kind of Marxist dialectic worldview of history, those who were steeped in Marxist scholarship, who believed that they could really read history's tea leaves correctly, thought that because of this, they had the right and indeed the obligation to make revolutionary decisions on behalf of the rest of society, and that some of these decisions might be hard, might be brutal, and might have victims and collateral damage, but they needed to be made anyway. And this was the kind of thinking of the revolutionary who was now bureaucrat or minister or general secretary of the party. An example of where this brutal and often incompetent way of operating based on this eschatological view of working towards a glorious and utopian historical endpoint caused immense bloodshed and catastrophe would, of course, be collectivization. I've done several podcasts on collectivization previously. You should be able to find them if you search this this set of recordings. But I won't go into it too deeply now because I'm trying to do kind of an overview type thing. Any kind of resistance to the party, any kind of popular disapproval of policies or any kind of mass uprising could be explained by the fact that pre-revolutionary ideas still dominated Russia. This is the way the party saw it. That backward bourgeois or even feudal ideas still dominated Russia, and there would be an immense learning curve for the Russian people to go through, for these ideas essentially to be removed from them, and that the building of socialism was actually going to be a long and difficult process. There was a kind of Stalinist way of looking at the world when people complained of hardships and shortages to sort of roll their eyes and say, well, of course there are hardships. We're building socialism. Of course there are difficulties. This isn't meant to be nice. It's meant to be easy. Communism is going to be the good bit, and we're going to get there. I'm not exactly sure quite when, but that's where we're going. This bit is meant to be difficult. This is a time of struggle. And communists had with them this deep sense of mission, this sense that they were the interpreters of history, and they had been educated and enlightened in the way that the masses hadn't, and that if they were simply allowed to take everybody with them, then there would be no problems. But certainly they couldn't be swayed by anything as primitive as popular opinion. This was another reason why an economic revolution and Stalin with the five-year plans needed to be accompanied by a cultural revolution. The backwardness of the Russian people, the dominance of old Tsarist ideas such as religion and feudalism and superstition and the methods of peasant farming, all this needed to be swept away. It was impossible in the view of the Stalinists to have an economic revolution if one simply allowed old ideas to persist. The one would sabotage the other. And the other term that was one which attracted a great deal of negativity was that of bourgeois or petty bourgeois. Anything that was considered to be counter-revolutionary or considered to be, for want of a better term, bad in the moral reasonings of the post-revolutionary era could be written off as being bourgeois. Small trade, the ownership of luxuries, certain kinds of fashion and dress, certain ways of self-expression, certain desires for privacy or for some kind of exception, some kind of privilege. All these things could be seen as bourgeois, and depending at what time and what place one was accused of being bourgeois, there were a range of sanctions, and none of them particularly pleasant, and some of them by 1936-37 particularly lethal. There were some ideas that died hard in Russia, or failed to die at all, and one was this notion of paternalism, that the figure of Stalin replaced neatly the figures of the Tsar, the little father, the Batushka. As Stalin deviated from whatever democratic notions there ever had been in Soviet communism towards a autocratic cult of personality based rule. So the traditions of paternalism emerged, and it wasn't simply the fact that the state propaganda created this. State propaganda obviously created a cult of personality, but it had a fairly receptive audience among Russian people who were used to thinking about an autocratic leader who had the nation's best interests in his mind, who could sort of hold the nation as a father cradles a baby, that kind of sentiment. And within that idea, we can see how pre-existing traditional notions, very kind of deep old Russian peasant notions, meet with the modern ideas of Soviet communism and intertwine and meld and merge and create a sort of hybrid concepts. Because the party viewed itself as a revolutionary vanguard as opposed to a more gradual kind of social democratic party, it had a very particular attitude when it came to the population at large. This idea of vanguard can be explained as this. When Lenin wrote What Is To Be Done, he really articulated the notion of revolutionary vanguard. In essence, he said that the population, the proletarian population in Russia was small, the peasant population was very large, the peasant population was unlikely to get with the programme as far as socialism went particularly soon, and the working classes would take a long time to organise themselves as well. The working class was too small to have a kind of revolutionary potential, and so if you were going to wait, as Marx had suggested, if you're going to wait for the working classes to organise themselves, to create their own institutions and then overthrow capitalism, you'd be waiting for a very long time, in which time the Tsar would have figured out what the revolutionaries' cunning plans were and either A, slung them all in jail, or B, more likely, done the sensible thing and co-opted the middle classes into government and society, and thus draining away any revolutionary potential from the movement at all. So Lenin said, instead of waiting for the workers to figure things out for themselves and seize power, we will be a vanguard. We will seize power on their behalf. And then, once we have power and we hold it in trust on their behalf, we will use it to build the socialist society that will benefit them. And we will, by nature, understand what that society is and should be. Even if they don't know quite what's good enough for them, what's good for them, we will impose it on them because it is the right thing to do, because we understand history in the right way and we know what is best for them in ways that they don't know for themselves at the moment. And they will eventually, when they get to the communist utopia at the end of all of this, everything will be great. And so
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
So communism, the final goal, was a thing that was always somewhere in the future. Always something to be worked towards, and there would always be struggle in the present. And if you were to look at Stalinist society from 1928 through to 1953, you would conclude that there was certainly struggle in the present and many obstacles to overcome. When communism was meant to arrive was differed depending on who you asked, whether it could be achieved in 10 years, 20 years, 50 years, 100 years. Nobody quite knew, and the date at which communism was meant to emerge would keep going, being set back and back and back. How would we know when communism is here? Well, again, this is a very difficult thing to quantify. Marx didn't give much of an impression about what communism would look like. It was left to subsequent theorists to suggest this. One of the barriers for entry to the party, and one of the things that keeps the party in an air of exclusivity, is the complexities of Marxist-Leninist thinking. Party members were steeped in a vast amount of complicated, esoteric and arcane articles, journals, books and information about the historical view and the philosophical view of everything from the development of capitalist profit to the culture of capitalist societies and how socialism might be built and defended in a socialist state such as the Soviet Union. And the perception that developed around party members who were scholars of Marxist-Leninism and as the works of Stalin was that these were keepers of very particular kinds of knowledge and that they were able to now speak the language of the new regime and use this knowledge to help navigate around this complex and bewildering new ideological force that had implanted itself at the heart of what had previously been traditional Russian society. For those that did understand it, the principal force in history was now social class. For those who were not versed in Marxist-Leninist discourse, the idea of class was still a prevalent one in their daily life, whether they understood class particularly well or not. Those that were true believers within the party saw Marxist-Leninist discourse as a set of scientific rules to understand society and history, much as there are scientific rules to understand the physical laws of the universe. And these scientific rules were followed absolutely and fundamentally. They were the map to utopia, to communism. And if this didn't emerge, it was either that the rule book was being misread or misunderstood somehow, or if this possibility was eliminated, then there must be saboteurs. When things went wrong within Soviet society, there were food shortages, housing shortages, accidents in factories, largely caused by incompetence and poor planning and a lack of any understanding, really, of basic structures of government and logistics. It was put down to external sabotage or internal sabotage because it couldn't possibly be that Marxist-Leninism was in some way at fault. There must be someone to blame. And this idea that there should be someone to blame, that there should be an enemy to catch, was a force which manifests itself in its most crudest and brutal during the Great Terror, But as Robert Service points out, the Great Terror is just one moment in a kind of an ongoing terror that exists within Soviet society. And because of the singular significance of class, class origin and class background is woven into all aspects of life. Class identity determines the availability of work, education, housing, food, and permits to reside in cities or to be exiled to Siberia. The notion of class as an explanatory factor in people's behaviour, their outlook and their levels of loyalty was not dissimilar to the way in which the Gestapo in Germany factored ideas of race into the likelihood of criminal behaviour having taken place, or the assumption of guilt or innocence. Party membership in the Soviet Union was essential for advancement and for the ability to acquire scarce resources. The membership of the party was highly desirable, and those who came from bad class backgrounds or who had been eliminated by being refused access to the Young Pioneers or the Komsomol found membership of the party extremely difficult. There was a need to be in the party for personal ambition, and this meant that party members or the party machine spent a lot of time and effort trying to sift between those who are ambitious in that they wanted to participate in the building of socialism and those who were ambitious who were careerists and who wanted simply advancement and privilege, a arguably bourgeois notion from the point of view of the Stalinists. And it was those who were simply looking to advance themselves that generally tended to actually do far better within the party machinery, even though ostensibly this was discouraged. In the 20s and 30s, getting into the party wasn't that easy. There were all manner of checks and balances to make sure that this was not a fait accompli. Those who had supposedly bourgeois backgrounds found it very difficult. It was exclusively in the 20s and 30s by and large for proletarians. Enrollment rules made sure that workers and peasants gained entry to the party, and in addition to that, there were many sort of ambitious or attempted or hopeful communists who managed to be eliminated during the admissions procedure, who were required to submit references. They had their social backgrounds investigated. They went through examinations examining their political literacy, and they were rigorously scrutinised as to their suitability. So much so that in 1930 it could be said that the Communist Party was indeed a proletarian party. The emphasis was to bring in proletarian factory workers and to keep out people with bourgeois backgrounds. And the huge wave of workers who entered the party during the five-year plan meant that the party grew dramatically and gained people notionally of the right class background, but they also gained an awful lot of new members with poor levels of education, who were poorly motivated politically, but actually were as avaricious and self-interested and motivated by self-advancement as any of the people that the party sought to sift out. In 1933, the party suspended its admissions and removed unsuitable members from its books, Also, obviously, during the Great Purges, there were large numbers of members who were arrested and executed. During the 1930s, some young party members who joined found themselves dramatically and rapidly promoted to positions far beyond their experience or competence, and this meant that the party itself was a very unstable machinery for governance, and one where there were frequently high levels of incompetence. And this explains an awful lot about the Soviet Union during the Stalin era. It was an era where very little seemed to work, where there were shortages of food, housing, where initiatives that were ostensibly designed to improve public life met with considerable failure, and where many infrastructure projects were botched jobs that were rushed through by party men who knew very little about what they were doing but thought they could manage the situation with brute force and aggression. Following the Great Terror, when party admission reopened at the end of the 1930s, proletarian fantasies were swept aside, and the idea of getting people from good class backgrounds was nowhere near as important as getting competent and educated people in place. Stalin, at this period, by this point, had an obsession with the threat of Germany, not an irrational one, as we subsequent events tell us, and knew that he was in a race against time to reinforce the structures of Soviet life to prepare for an inevitable onslaught later on. We'll try to check in on this topic and look a little bit more at the inner workings of the party. There's a lot to be said on this subject. So stay tuned in the next week or so. I'll try to update this one. Anyway, thanks very much for listening. I hope you found this interesting, and I'll catch you on the next podcast. By all means, say hi on the Explaining History Facebook page. We've got some great chats on there. And also, if you can, give us a good thumbs up on iTunes. That would be very helpful. Thanks very much. All the best. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.